مسلمانان بچ دل ما کشان مسلمانان بچ دل ما کشان نمی دانم وطن چی ابال نمی دانم وطن چی ابال
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from the northern part of Afghanistan is Robert Young Pelton, who's an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the founder and publisher of SomaliaReport.com, and he's had first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgents groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns, and the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurous. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Young Pelton.
Thank you.
So you're back in Afghanistan, and I guess it's some kind of a bookend because you went in with the first American Special Forces in the initial American invasion in response to 9/11. You were there filming, I think, for National Geographic at the time when the American CIA officer was killed. And the American jihadi, John Walker Lind, was captured. So what's the sense now of coming back after all those years? Is it, what kind of progress have we made, I guess, is my question.
Well, you know, I'm here, I guess, exactly 11 years to the day. And I'm with the same type of people doing the same type of thing. So it's fascinating to see the contrast. For example, the city of Mazar-e Sharif is a vast, sprawling metropolis now. And the American presence is also a vast, sprawling metropolis. And the interesting thing is that nobody's throwing anything down. There's a lot of talk on the American side about pulling troops out and sort of pulling out, but nobody actually really was saying that. The America's presence will still remain.
Well, there are reports that the U.S. and the Afghani government, if that's not too generous a description, are in talks trying to craft an agreement of what kind of American footprint there will be after 2014. What's your sense of where... what kind of footprint the U.S. is going to have after the 2014 withdrawal?
Well, first of all, they're building permanent installations over there, so there will be a permanent military presence in Afghanistan. Secondly, they're doing what the Russians tried to do, is to set up a 500,000 man security force, but that security force is nowhere near at any level that would provide stability. And there still is fighting. You know, every day there's troops in contact, there's casualties, airstrikes. The war goes on. So what I'm going to imagine is you're going to see a lot of the regular troops be pulled back, but a lot of this is just going to disappear from the headlines. There'll still be American troops with building permanent bases. You just won't see the regular troops, and you won't see much coverage of the actual fighting that will go on.
So if the U.S. continues fighting and continues its presence, it would obviously need air power to make up for the lack of boots on the ground. How can you maintain an air force in a landlocked country where the Pakistanis control the supply routes and they're obviously supporting the Taliban? How's that going to work out?
I think the whole strategy here is going to go toward very targeted strikes and... there's going to be a large intelligence capability. There's a lot of contractors. There's a lot of special operations troops. And what they're trying to do is just wait until the Afghan forces can actually handle the number of attacks by Taliban and insurgent forces. You know, what's interesting is a lot of the attacks here are not by the Taliban. They're by local groups who are simply fighting against the Karzai government. It's a very different dynamic than it was 10 years ago.
So explain that further. I mean, is this going to revert to
well,
the...
In 2001, you had actually a very large Taliban ground force made out of Pakistani recruits and Afghan soldiers, and they were mechanized, just like a traditional, almost like a Russian army. Today, what you're seeing is numerous small fighting and uprisings in rural areas in which the people may or may not be aligned with the Taliban at all. You're seeing local groups actually fighting against the Karzai government, pushing back from the control of the central government. And it's a very confusing dynamic because, you know, people may have very regional reasons for fighting against the government forces. So you're not seeing that coordinated attack like you saw a long time ago, 10 years ago.
So is this a return to warlordism? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, people see that in 2014, I think April 2014 is when the election is supposed to happen. They know that Karzai won't come back in power, and everybody is consolidating their positions here. So they're not really bowing down to the Afghan army or the Afghan police, who are quite new at what they're doing. And so they're pushing back. If a large, you know, military unit goes into a small village, they will actually be attacked, which is quite amazing because they're not respecting the centralized control of force.
Well, the idea of an Afghan national army has always been something of a myth, but I thought that much of its makeup were the non-Pashtun tribes. So if you're in the area of the non-Pashtun tribes, why are they hostile to an army that's largely made up of recruits from their tribes?
Well, for, I'm north of the Hindu Kush. There are some Pashtun pockets here. But you got to remember, there's Uzbeks, there's Turkmen, there's Hazaras, there's Aimaks. There's a number of ethnic groups, but there's also a number of business and criminal groups who never actually see the army. And they literally send the army out just to show presence, and the locals will respond by firing back at them. And it's an interesting situation because the idea of providing this $500 million security force is always something that was written on paper. It was never actually something that was exercised. And as you know, it didn't work out that well during the Russian period, and it's probably not going to work out that well during the 2014 transition from American control of force to Afghan control of force.
So, Robert Young Pelton, in northern Afghanistan, it would seem then that what you're talking about here in the post-2014 American deployment, continued deployment in Afghanistan, is kind of a few Fort Apaches in a very hostile land.
You're going to see mission creep because as the traditional forces move out and a lot of the infrastructure projects move out, you're going to see bases staffed with Americans, staffed with contractors, partnering with Afghans, everything from local police to army to special forces, desperately trying to keep control over the landscape so that a centralized government in Kabul can claim control. But I think what you're going to see is something very different. And, you see this all over the world. You see this in Yemen. You see this in Somalia, where they pretend that there's a central government, but the local people still control their destiny.
So just to get a handle on the supply situation, because, to get a gallon of gasoline to the Marines, for example, in Helmand, I believe, was, $90 a gallon it ends up at, or maybe even over 100. And the Pakistanis have closed off the supply routes on a number of occasions. Is the northern supply route working through the former Soviet Union? Is that secure and viable?
No, the material here is still flowing in. I mean, they actually still fly in aviation gas for aircraft, if you can believe it. And all the American installations all run off generators. There's no economy here. There's no sort of giant wellspring of oil or fuel or supplies. All the food that's served at the American bases is flown in from other countries. They don't buy it locally. But it's still the same sort of bizarre space station supply route.
So again, I'm speaking with Robert Young-Pelton, who is in northern Afghanistan. He went into Afghanistan with the first special forces back in 2001, 2002, and is returning after 11 years, having visited a number of times. And we're talking about where things stand. Going back to your experience with the captured prisoners who rioted and killed the CIA officer, all of which you witnessed, and then the American prisoner, John Walker Lind, the special forces actually handed him over to you until the Marines came and put him in custody. So you've had quite a long experience and interest in what's happening there. I mean, you went in with an older generation of special forces, much more seasoned. The newer generation that you're in with now, are they as kind of you know, smart and I guess cautious is the word to say?
The new generation is actually more aggressive than the old generation, but the command structure is very risk adverse. I mean, you have to remember when in 2001 when Special Forces landed here, they were on horseback and they were happy to get one of their six-wheel gators after their campaign. Today, they have to drive in MRAPs and 52,000-pound mine-resistant vehicles, and there are extraordinary number of restrictions on the use of violence, airstrikes, et cetera, et cetera. So we're sort of micromanaging a very risk-averse war right now.
But the original Special Forces were a little more attuned to culture and local customs. Are these soldiers that are going to be staying behind? Are they going to be in tune with the people or just, you know, hunkered down in forts, feeling isolated and paranoid? That's the picture I'm seeing. But
yeah, well, the new generation very much wants to live amongst the population, but they can't. They have to stay on military bases. They work hand in hand. They're right there in combat with Afghan soldiers, and many times they get caught up in the same kind of violence and casualties and problems that the Afghan soldiers have. So they are probably closer to the battle than at any time in our history here. But yes, they're not allowed to live sort of in the city or in the villages amongst the people, but they are trying to set up a very village-centric type of defense force, which is what we should have done 10 years ago, is we sort of go to each village and let them form their own security apparatus, because the larger army is probably not working that well. It really doesn't have the same kind of fight or heart that the local villagers do. So today, Special Forces troops are better trained, better equipped, but at the same time, they're micromanaged and they're prevented from doing the very thing they're trained to do best, which is to get out into the boonies and fight alongside
So you mentioned, Robert Young-Pelton, the Karzai government and the elections in 2014, which Karzai, of course, can't run again, but he's trying to influence the outcome. But the impression that you get, that I get at least from talking to specialists on Afghanistan, is that the Karzai clan are essentially a bunch of narco-kleptocrats, and they've parked God knows how much money in Dubai, much of which has come from the American taxpayer. And then, of course, there's that proliferation of what they call poppy palaces in Kabul, in the wealthy neighborhoods. Give us a sense of the difference between the elites and their poppy palaces and these kind of mud brick villages that the special forces are trying to defend.
Right. Well, as you know, we've poured billions of dollars into Afghanistan, and we have created a process that forces us to push that money through the government so that the government looks like it's handing out this money. And of course, that government has skimmed off large amounts of that government of that money. When you get out to the Afghan villages, they look exactly the same as they did 10, 20, 30 years ago, and they haven't seen much impact of the central government. Many of these people are very aware that they can vote and that they want to change or have some kind of benefit from the government, but I think they've turned away from the idea that a central government will solve their problems. So we're seeing more regionalization of politics, and the people that actually put Karzai back into power, which is, of course, General Dostum and Mahathir and these ethnic minorities, have banded together. They provided 42% of Karzai's vote last time. And so they're busy working on the grassroots part of the politics. And I don't know what's going to happen in 2014, but the people here in Afghanistan are both somewhat despondent that they think the Americans are leaving, and at the same time, you know, hopeful that Karzai will leave. They don't have an answer. They don't have some person picked out that they'd like to see in power. But they're not very happy that Obama has publicly said that we're leaving the country, even though privately we're not.
So what about, though, the morale amongst the U.S. forces there? If they, I mean, how are they reacting, for example, to the much-storied General Petraeus, who, of course, is responsible for the surge that didn't seem to amount to very much in terms of achievements? And then, of course, you got General Allen, the general in charge, supposedly to be heading up NATO soon. He's swept up in this scandal, which is really kind of a tawdry soap opera involving a bunch of sort of tacky people down in Florida. How do the officers and men there in Afghanistan, how are they responding to this soap opera?
Well, I think American troops in Afghanistan they like the country, they like the mission, they want to do something, but they're almost shocked at the way that the higher levels conduct themselves. For example, you know, General McKinney was fired, General McChrystal was fired, General Petraeus was brought in, you know, to patch up his program here. General Allen seems to be in trouble. It just seems to be an odd run of bad luck at the high command. And there's been a number of shifts in programs from the top down. And I know, you know, I can't speak exactly about what I know, but at the same time, I've seen that exact micromanagement where the ground troops know how to fight the war, but yet people at the head said they'll micromanage what they do for some political, you know, either based on discussions with the Karzai government or trying to manage risk here. So you see two goals. One is to win the war, which I don't think will happen. And the second one is to protect the lives and the safety of the troops within the confines of the Afghan legal environment. It's quite confusing.
But, I mean, there's been 11 commanders in 11 years. That's got to be a little confusing for the people down the ranks, surely.
Well, the one thing to remember is that, you know, we were supposed to shift our military focus from Europe and Japan towards the Middle East, and Iraq was supposed to be one of our strategic toeholds, and we lost that when the Iraqis didn't sign the agreement. So Afghanistan is really our next big permanent toehold, you know, in between sort of the Iran and other sort of fragile countries here. So I think even though politically President Obama wants us to end the war in Afghanistan, we're actually not. We're just going to shift into another phase.
So, in other words, they want to somehow get the Afghans to shoulder the so-called burden, and get most of the U.S. troops out. But they also want to maintain a permanent presence through bases in that neighborhood. Is that the summary?
Well, we've seen this in the drone war in Pakistan. You know, theoretically, we're not at war, and yet we fly hundreds of drone missions and kill thousands of people every year, and yet we're not at war in Pakistan. You're seeing a very disturbing shift from open wars to covert wars. For example, in Mali, we're starting like a new proxy war to clear out al-Qaeda, just like we did in Somalia, where we paid Uganda, you know, to fight our war in Somalia. So you're seeing a shift from public wars to private wars. And you see the politicians insist that we're not fighting a war over here, and yes, we very much are fighting a war over here.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us and giving us your unique perspective. Since Robert Young Pelton, you've been there from the beginning, and you're just back there now for a month. I thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, and as always.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Young-Pelton, who's an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the founder and publisher of Somalia Report, and he has had a first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. And we're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with a former CIA Kabul station chief.
Southern Empire, the newborn of the hammock rocks, below a bolted sky that unlocks for the departing of the flux from the shadow of an empire. God loves a triad, an articulate.